From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
Under the Rockefeller drug laws, I served 16 years. Not saying that I didn't commit a crime, but the crime did not warrant the time.
Today, we'll take a look at the story of Elaine Bartlett as people behind bars around the country hope for Christmas clemency. And some people have children named after them. Bush's national security advisor has a Chevron oil tanker named for her. It's called the Condoleezza Rice. We'll look at the growing oiligarchy. Both Condoleezza Rice and Don Evans expected to be the new Commerce Secretary, an oil man from Midland, Texas. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. President-elect George W. Bush plans to announce his choices today to head the U.S. Departments of Commerce, Agriculture, and Housing and Urban Development. In a news conference at the University of Texas, Bush will nominate longtime friend and campaign chair Don Evans as Commerce Secretary. In addition, Bush will announce that he's chosen Mel Martinez, chair of Orange County, Florida's Board of Commissioners, to be Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, and Ann Veneman, California's Agriculture Director, to become Agriculture Secretary. This, according to Republican officials, close to the process. Ann Veneman is an attorney who is the daughter of peach farmers and emphasized foreign trade during her tenure as California's agriculture director. She was appointed by former Republican Governor Pete Wilson and served as California's agriculture secretary from 1995 until January of last year. Wilson sent her on trade missions to Asia and South America looking for new markets for California's agricultural products. She's a strong advocate of high-tech's role in farming, from e-commerce over the internet to genetic engineering. The conviction on civil rights counts of five policemen accused of beating a black man to death in New Jersey has prompted renewed calls for homicide charges. The Orange, New Jersey officers were found guilty of civil rights violations yesterday by a federal jury. They have not been charged with killing Earl Faison, who died in police custody less than an hour after being arrested. The New Jersey State Attorney General's office had concluded there was insufficient evidence of homicide. Faison was arrested after the murder of policewoman Joyce Carnegie. He was among four black men detained in the days after Carnegie was killed. The last of the four, Condell Woodson, confessed to the crime and is serving a life sentence. Faison's father said the officers should face murder charges. In other criminal justice news, Steve Cooley, the newly elected district attorney in Los Angeles County, instructed his staff yesterday to limit the use of California's three strikes laws, telling them to prosecute cases only when a third offense was a serious or violent felony. The law was passed in 1994 and carries a sentence of 25 years to life in prison for third-time offenders. Cooley, who won 64% of the vote, had made the policy the main focus of his campaign, charging that the previous policy resulted in coercive plea bargaining that was revealed in the L.A. police corruption scandal. More than 100 criminal convictions have been thrown out due to police wrongdoing. In international news, Israeli soldiers shot dead two Palestinians in the Gaza Strip today as negotiators for the two sides tried at secluded talks near Washington to salvage peacemaking battered by weeks of violence. Palestinian hospital officials and witnesses said Hani Yusuf al-Sufi, who was 14 years old, was killed during a gun battle in Gaza's Rafah district near the Egyptian border, and five schoolgirls were among 20 others wounded. Expectations are low as negotiators begin separate talks with U.S. mediators in Washington. Meanwhile, the United Nations Human Rights Commission yesterday appointed a three-member team to investigate human rights violations in the Palestinian territories. The team's appointment was called for by a human rights resolution, which narrowly passed in October and which condemned Israel for, quote, widespread, systematic, and gross violation of human rights. The resolution was opposed by the United States. Israel has said it will not cooperate with the inquiry. Ignoring protests from aid groups and several countries, the UN Security Council yesterday gave Afghanistan a month to surrender Osama bin Laden or suffer new sanctions. The United States and Russia lobbied the 13 other Security Council members hard to adopt the resolution. However, aid groups and UN Secretary General Kofi Annan objected, saying that residents of the country ravaged by 20 years of war, brutal poverty, and persistent drought will suffer. Neighboring Pakistan objected the most strenuously. Pakistan receives limited international aid and no UN assistance to feed or house the 2 million Afghan refugees already living in the country. And soldiers trying to regain control of Turkey's large communal prison wards brought in bulldozers today to break holes in the walls, but prisoners barricaded inside were still evading the troops. As the clashes entered a second day in Istanbul, Turkey, at least 18 people have died. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Yes, and good day to our listeners around the country. And those of you out there who are falling behind on your credit card payments or being harassed by bill collectors, take heart. President Clinton feels your pain. And with 1 month left to go in office, he did a pocket veto yesterday of the reform of the personal bankruptcy laws that the bank industry had sought to make it tougher for working people who are dogged by bill collectors to be able to declare bankruptcy. And Clinton, who has about $4 or $5 million in bills himself, legal bills, from the Monica Lewinsky case and impeachment, apparently has felt that pain. And so he exercised a fourth pocket veto of his administration.
Juan, this breaking news, actually, we got this over the internet, and I've gotten it so many times in the last few minutes that I felt it was very important to read, and journalists around the country should take note. God has overruled the Supreme Court verdict, giving Bush the presidential victory. Let me read the article, Bush to be smitten, later today. In a stunning development this morning, God invoked the One Nation Under God clause of the Pledge of Allegiance to overrule the Supreme Court decision that handed the White House to George Bush. God said in a rare television appearance, "I'm not sure where the Supreme Court gets off, but I'm sure as hell not going to lay back and let Bush get away with this ball." She went on to say,
"Oh,
I've watched
the burning Bush theory."
I've watched analysts argue for weeks now that the exact vote count in Florida will never be known. Well, I'm God, and I do know exactly who voted for whom. Let's cut to the chase. Gore won Florida by exactly 20,219 votes. Shocking political analysts and pundits, God's unexpected verdict overrules the official Electoral College tally and awards Florida to Al Gore, giving him a 289-246 victory. The Bush campaign is analyzing God's word for possible grounds for appeal. God's ruling is a classic overreach, argued Bush campaign strategist Jim Baker. He went on to say, clearly a divine intervention in a U.S. presidential election is unprecedented, unjust, and goes against the Constitution of the state of Florida. Jim Baker's a jackass, God responded. He's got some surprises ahead of him, let me tell you, hot ones, if you know what I mean. God, who provided the exact vote counts for every Florida precinct, explained that bad balloting machinery and voter confusion were no grounds to give the White House to a friggin' idiot. Look, only 612 people in Palm Beach County voted for Buchanan. Get real. The rest meant to vote for Gore. Don't believe me? I'll name them. Anderson Pete, Anderson Sam Jr., Arthur James, Barnhart Ron. Our Laura then went on to note that she was displeased with George W. Bush's prideful ways and announced that she would officially smite him today. In an act of wrath unlike any reported since the Book of Job, God has taken all of Bush's goats and livestock, stripped him of his wealth and possessions, sold his family into slavery, forced the former presidential candidate into hard labor in a salt mine, and afflicted him with deep boils. Dick Cheney will reportedly receive leprosy. That late-breaking news report from the internet. Well, Juan, today we're going to take a look at the growing oligarchy as the appointments of George W. Bush are announced. Today, the president-select will announce that his old crony Don Evans will be Secretary of Commerce. Evans is an executive of Tom Brown, Inc., a Midlands, Texas oil and gas company. The appointment gives the 54-year-old executive control of Commerce's 31,000 employees in a sprawling government bureaucracy that's responsible for promoting trade, counting the number of Americans, measuring the economy, and approving patents. The post is a prize for Evans, who raised a record $100 million for Bush's campaign. According to the New York Times, Evans' public policy experience is limited to service on the University of Texas Board of Regents, a position Bush named him to after Evans helped lead previous Bush campaign efforts. We're going to talk about Don Evans as well as Condoleezza Rice, who was named over the weekend as the National Security Advisor of George Bush. She has been earning accolades, most recently from one of Bush's stalwart supporters, Chevron Corporation, which named one of its oil tankers the Condoleezza Rice in her honor. We're joined by Chuck Lewis, founder and executive director of the Center for Public Integrity in Washington, D.C., and Robert Bryce, who is a staff writer with the Austin Chronicle in Texas.
Well, Chuck Lewis, your reaction to the Evans nomination that seems likely today, and your sense of Evans?
This is kind of predictable in that the Commerce Secretary post usually goes to political types who have helped the president-elect, and this goes way, way, way back. We remember Maurice Stans back with Nixon, Ron Brown, who delivered the White House or helped deliver the White House to Bill Clinton, Robert Mulsbacher under President Bush before Brown, all the way up. Mickey Cantor was Commerce Secretary, who was campaign chairman to Clinton, Bill Daley, who's just recently been Gore's campaign chairman. So there is a long pattern of basically the Commerce Department being a political dumping ground where there are literally hundreds of political appointees there, and the idea is to be the ambassador to business, to work closely, among other things, with the donors that helped get you there and to lay the groundwork for 2004. And the perception has always been that it's an overly politicized agency that is very, very politically bent towards election and reelection. And this perception is so strong that in 1996, House Republicans voted to eliminate the department altogether because they were so furious and frustrated with all the revelations surrounding the late Ron Brown and how he ran the place. So here we go. The money man for Bush, who raised three times the amount any presidential candidate has ever had in U.S. history, including $70 million the year before the election, and who enabled Bush to outspend McCain in the crucial South Carolina primary 5-1, the most single important person in the entire Bush saga the past year, it got this post, and it's in that sense not surprising at all.
What about his oil connections, Don Evans? And just, you know, we joke each day talking about the growing oiligarchy, but one after another, and we'll talk about Condoleezza Rice in a minute on the board of Chevron with her namesake and a Chevron oil tanker. But in the case of Don Evans, this Midland, Texas company that he heads.
Well, you know, honestly, in our book, The Buying of the President 2000, we mentioned that he's the chief executive of that company. But I have to tell you, I think there may be more scrutiny now on this company. I'm not an expert on the Thom Browne company, and perhaps your other guest is, but I don't think we know enough. But you're absolutely right. You have a president, a vice president, first time in U.S. history that the two top slots in the U.S. government are from one industry, and namely the oil industry. And now you have a commerce secretary, also from the oil industry, and you have other ties. Let's not forget the chief of staff to the president-elect is the chief lobbyist for the auto industry and worked with polluters to loosen clean air standards, which also is favored by the oil industry. So, and we're just starting here. These are the earliest appointments. We haven't even gotten to the whoever's going to be the Secretary of Energy, which frequently, sometimes at least, comes from oil.
Robert Bryce, the staff writer for the Austin Chronicle, can you enlighten us a little bit about the Thom Browne company?
Well, I think, you know, just looking through the SEC filings, I think that Evans is going to face some similar questions to those that were posed to Dick Cheney. Their latest proxy statement shows that Evans owns about options on about 1.1 million shares in the company. And if my math is correct, the discerning exactly how much those options are worth is difficult without going back through multiple proxies, which I haven't had time to do. But if Thom Browne's stock price has surged dramatically over the last year due to the uptick in both natural gas and oil prices, by my count, those options are worth $16 million right now. Now, not all of those are exercisable immediately. But, you know, Cheney faced the same questions about what, you know, given that if he's going to be the vice president, what is he going to do with those options? Is he going to keep them? Is he going to put them in a trust, et cetera? The other is that Evans owns 2.7% of Thom Browne, Inc., which is a relatively small independent natural gas and oil exploration company and production company. But he also owns 1 million shares outright, which are worth about $30 million. At today's prices. So, you know, these questions about, you know, what is he going to do once he gets in office with those things, I think are very germane. As far as why, you know, just to follow on Chuck Lewis's point, you know, this is not surprising at all, I don't think. Bush made Evans, or handed Evans, the most powerful patronage job in Texas once he became governor, and that is he made him the chairman of the Board of Regents at the University of Texas. I think it is the largest public university in the United States, and it's a powerful patronage position because it has 76,000 employees. The annual budget is $5.4 billion, and the Regents manage an investment portfolio worth $14 billion. So, you know, the patronage connection or patronage jobs for Evans and Bush is nothing new.
Can you tell us about other boards Don Evans, who may well be the next Commerce Secretary, sits on?
I don't know that, but I'll tell you one kind of what I think is kind of amusing is once Evans was appointed the head Bush's finance committee, you know, when Bush announced for president, people were saying in Austin, well, okay, so Evans is the CEO of Thom Browne, which is a full-time job. He's the chairman of the UT Board of Regents, which is a full-time job, and he's the head of Bush's finance team, which is a full-time job. So how does he manage to do all of them? And one Democratic wag here in Austin said, well, what makes you think those jobs are any different?
Robert Bryce, staff writer for the Austin Chronicle. One more point on the issue of the whole oil team, since you're in Texas, the significance of Cheney heading Halliburton, you know, the largest oil services company in the world. Of course, George Bush himself with his own failed oil companies. And then you've got Don Evans, and then we're moving on to Condoleezza Rice.
And I'm sorry.
Just commenting on oil politics in Texas for people around the country who may not be as immersed in
it. Well, I mean, you know, Texas has you know, largely transformed over the last couple of decades away from oil and cattle to computers and you know, other high-tech related industries. But, you know, the good old boy network in Texas is still largely based on, you know, the oil business, and, you know, and those people are still around. They still, you know, particularly of late, there's been a huge resurgence of the importance of those ties simply because of the rise in oil prices. So, you know, Texas is still an oil state. It still produces more oil than any other state in the country and will for some time to come. And you know, as natural gas plays a bigger role in the economy and in generating electricity, Bush made it clear that in laying out his energy policy in September that, you know, strength giving the oil industry and the pipeline industries more power is definitely part of his plan. And so look for, in his presidency, efforts to increase the number of oil and gas pipelines being put in, which is what hasn't happened for decades, but I predict that it will under his presidency.
Robert Bryce, staff writer for the Austin Chronicle, and Chuck Lewis, founder and director of the Center for Public Integrity in Washington. We're going to come back with you both just for a minute. I wanted to ask Chuck Lewis about Condoleezza Rice, the new national security advisor for George W. Bush. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Back in a minute. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez. Tomorrow we're going to be looking at Colin Powell and Condoleezza Rice, the foreign policy establishment as we know it so far under George W. Bush, and their connections or not connections to Africa. But right now we're looking at Don Evans, looks like he will be the new Commerce Secretary, and Condoleezza Rice in other aspects of her experience. Chuck Lewis, the Center for Public Integrity, who is she, and what is her story?
Well, of course, she served in the National Security Council under former President Bush and has been the provost at Stanford the last several years, which is a very, you know, pretty major management job, among other things, but a different kind of job, not involving foreign policy. But the reason, I mean, what's also interesting that has emerged, I'd say, in the past week is, at least to most people, I didn't realize it, and I don't think many did, that she has been on the board of directors of Chevron, and in fact that there's a tanker named after her, and through the Chevron connection has met with various folks around the world to discuss foreign policy, but of course with thoughts towards oil and energy issues around the world. But it casts another light. First of all, I never really realized that a provost of a university had corporate ties generally. I mean, I guess every university has its own rules, and that you could have another show on the ties of professors and university officials to corporations, and is Publisher Parrish really what they do now, or they mostly consult? That's a whole separate show, maybe. But this is a new wrinkle. Again, this is not anything that the Congress would have a problem with, and the National Security Advisor, as I recall, is not even a confirmable post. It's a White House staff position. No one's going to raise hackles over what I just said, but it is another person with another tie to oil, and it's not something anyone knew about Condoleezza Rice more than a week ago.
Publisher, perish, drill, or kill. we'll have to investigate. I mean, people know the Chevron story probably by now who are longtime listeners, but the tenure... Yes, Robert Bryce.
I didn't know anything about the tanker issue, but gosh, if I was her, I'd get my name off that tanker. What happens if it runs aground and there's an oil spill?
That's great.
or as has happened, unfortunately, all too often in Nigeria under Chevron, and that is Chevron bringing in the Nigerian military to its various vessels when Nigerian villagers protest. The Nigerian military known for opening fire on these villagers, and most recently in 98, killing two of them. But I want to thank you both very much for being with us. We're going to continue on the story, of course, in the days, weeks, months, and years to come as we cover the new Bush administration. Robert Bryce, staff writer with the Austin Chronicle in Texas, and Chuck Lewis in Washington, D.C., the Center for Public Integrity. Your website, Chuck?
Yeah, www.publicintegrity.org. Public Integrity is one word.
And the Austin Chronicle?
It's www.oscron.com.
Thank you both for being with us.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you. We're going to move now to the streets of New York, where a protest is taking place outside the Brooklyn House of Detention. We've brought you the story in the last few weeks of Clark Kissinger, who is a well-known activist on behalf of Mumia Abu-Jamal, who is a journalist on death row in Pennsylvania. Clark Kissinger is now being jailed at the Brooklyn House of Detention. We go to his colleague, Deborah Sweet, who's in the streets outside. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Hi. Actually, we've just ended a protest that started at 8 this morning. Clark is at the Brooklyn Metropolitan Detention Center, which is a federal facility, 3,500 people. And he's been here for a week without any change of clothes, without any ability to make phone calls or have visits from his family. So we've been protesting the isolation that Clark is being held under.
And for those of our listeners who don't know why he's in there, could you give us a quick recap?
Well, Clark was convicted of a petty offense with seven other people in July of 99, a protest at the Liberty Bell for Mumia. The seven people pled not guilty and asked for a trial and were summarily convicted by a federal judge and sentenced to 1 year probation, their passports taken away, forced to submit or asked to submit financial and contact information every month to the federal government. Clark refused to turn over names and the sources of people that give him money to do his work for Mumia. He also traveled to Philadelphia on August 1st during the Republican National Convention to give a speech against the death penalty and for Mumia. And this is what he was convicted for 2 weeks ago today. He was sentenced to 90 days in federal detention for the violation of probation.
What was the probation terms? How did he violate them?
He traveled out of his home district without permission, and he refused to turn over the names of people who have given him money and of anyone convicted of a crime that he's had any association with, which, of course, would include Mumia.
Uh-huh. And were part of the terms of the probation he cannot give be involved in political activity?
Well, in effect, that's what's happened, because every time he's asked for permission to travel to speak for anything having to do with Mumia, he's been denied permission, although he has been allowed to leave New York City to visit his parents.
And so at this point, he's been in isolation for a week and incommunicado for the last 2 days.
He has not been able to call out until just this morning at 7 o'clock. He was finally able to make a call to his wife. We have been able to get attorneys in to see him every day, but he hasn't been able to call out. He's had no access to clean clothes for a week, toothbrush, or any basic commissary items. And they're saying that all this is because he was convicted of such a minor crime that they're really not used to having people like him in this facility, and therefore they couldn't process him in a timely manner. And the demand we've been raising is that he be allowed to be in communication to continue his work for Mumia, and at least to have pen and paper and mail coming in so that he knows what's happening and we know what's happening with him. As we all know, political prisoners can have accidents, illnesses, and things happen to them when they're in a situation like this, and we're demanding that nothing untoward happened to Clark and that he get out as soon as possible. We're also filing an appeal of this conviction.
If people want to get more information, where can they call, Deborah Sweet?
They can call Clark's office at 212-571-0962. We're urging people to deluge.
One more time, that phone number?
212-571-0962.
I want to thank you for being with us, Deborah Sweet, a colleague of Clark Kissinger, well-known activist who has been calling for a new trial for Mumia Abu-Jamal as she stands in the streets outside the Brooklyn Metropolitan Detention Center in New York. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! As we continue on the issue of prisons in a slightly different way, well, for most of us, the Christmas season is a time for family and giving. For the unprecedented 2 million people in America's prisons, the largest prison population in the world, it's a season for some to cling to a slim hope for freedom. Because it's also clemency season. We've talked extensively about President Clinton, the possibility that among some of those he might grant clemency to, he is considering executive clemency for Leonard Peltier, the Native American activist in prison for a quarter of a century. And I know there are hundreds of phone calls that are pouring into the White House comment line every day around that case. But today we're going to talk about another issue. In honor of Jubilee Year 2000, some 650 faith leaders across the U.S. are asking President Clinton to grant clemency to and to release on supervised parole those federal prisoners who've served at least 5 years for low-level nonviolent involvement in drug cases. It's called the Coalition for Jubilee Clemency. Well, we're going to talk today to one woman who last year around this time was one of three women in New York State who were granted clemency by New York Governor George Pataki. And I'm going to read from the front page piece in today's Village Voice about her case. There's a picture of her on the cover called Freedom's Cost. Elaine Bartlett beat the odds and won her freedom after 16 years in prison. Now she battles life on the outside. This is the first couple of paragraphs. It's written by Jennifer Gonerman. Elaine Bartlett waved goodbye to the guard behind the front desk, strutted the last few yards to the prison's front door, and stepped out into the brisk winter morning. Snowflakes sprinkled her face and her black trench coat, but she did not pause to brush them off. As quickly as her 3-inch heels would permit, Elaine marched down the asphalt pathway toward an 18-foot chain-link fence. At 9:54 a.m. on January 26, 2000, after 16 years locked inside Bedford Hills Prison in Westchester County, New York, Elaine was finally going home. Suddenly, behind her, dozens of women began yelling. Elaine stopped, spun around, and looked up at the brick building that housed the prison school. Prisoners filled its windows, waving mittens, hats, and scarves. "We love you, Elaine," they shouted. "You go, girl." It was a Bedford Hills ritual she had participated in many times, shouting goodbyes to other women while her own prison sentence dragged on. Elaine raised both arms and waved back. Then she continued her journey to the prison's front gate. And it goes on to say that Elaine's arrest was a catastrophe not only for her, but for her children. In the fall of 1983, she carried a 4-ounce sack of cocaine from Harlem to Albany in a deal set up by an acquaintance who turned out to be a police informant. Not only was Elaine busted, but so was Nathan Brooks, the father of her two daughters. It was Elaine's first arrest. Under New York State's strict drug laws, she got 20 years to life. Nate got 25 years to life. In one afternoon, all of Elaine's children lost their mother, and her daughters also lost their father. Today we're joined by Elaine Bartlett and by the woman who wrote the two-part series in The Village Voice last week and this week, Jennifer Gonerman. We welcome you both to Democracy Now!
Thank you for having me here today.
So tell us how you ended up in prison, and then we'll talk about what this year out has been like.
In 1983, I agreed to carry a package up to Albany. I made a foolish decision, and it cost me 16 years of my life. At the time, I had no knowledge of the Rockefeller drug laws or what they entailed or the fact that I could be sent away for such a long period of time for them. In prison, I educated myself and I became knowledgeable of the Rockefeller drug laws. By that time, I had committed suicide because to go to trial where you have no wins, it's like committing suicide, not even recognizing it.
What do you mean? What decisions did you make?
by going to trial.
Instead of pleading out.
Pleading out or becoming a informer, even if I had makeup stories or just tell them what I felt they wanted to hear or anything, would have been better than me sitting in jail for 16 years. Not saying that I didn't commit a crime, but saying that the time wasn't justifiable. The time didn't warrant. The crime didn't warrant the time that they gave me. And
if you had pled out, what would you have gotten?
If I had copped out, I would have got a 5 to life, and I would have had to set somebody else up to receive that sentence.
Jennifer Gonerman, you've been writing quite a bit about the prison system in New York State now for quite a while. And could you tell us a little bit, put the Rockefeller drug laws in context? Obviously, they're named after, for those around the country who never heard of Nelson Rockefeller, the former governor of New York and fleeting vice president for a time, what the impact of the Rockefeller laws have been on the communities of New York.
And where they came from.
Certainly. In 1973, then-Governor Nelson Rockefeller effectively started the nation's war on drugs here in New York State with what are called the Rockefeller drug laws. They were the first mandatory sentencing laws for drug crimes. So what that meant was that if you went to trial and you were convicted, you got a mandatory sentence. The sentence was determined not by what the judge thought your culpability was, not whether you were a drug kingpin or a courier or a first-time offender, but your entire prison sentence was determined by the amount of drugs you had. So in Elaine's case, she carried 4 ounces of drugs that she was caught with. That qualified as an A1 felony, a top-tier felony. So it made, when she was convicted at trial, her mandatory sentence was 15 to life. For reasons the judge in this case never explained, he added an extra 5. She got 20 to life. Because these sentences are so incredibly stiff, as you can imagine, virtually everybody arrested under the Rockefeller drug laws pleads guilty. Whether they're innocent or guilty is almost beside the point. When you're facing possibly 15 to life, it's a chance you don't want to take. So you have well over 90 or 95% copping out to pleas like 3 to life, 5 to life. Oftentimes they have to wear a wire and access an informant, go back to their neighborhoods as a condition of the plea, not always, but sometimes. And the effect has been absolutely devastating for many, many neighborhoods. Over 94% of the drug prisoners in New York State are either African-American or Latino. We now have more than 22,000 drug prisoners in New York State, and that's out of a state prison population of a little more than 70,000. As a result of the Rockefeller drug laws, which are now 27 years old, there's been an incredible prison building boom in New York State and other states across this country with other similar mandatory sentencing laws. But New York has sort of the dubious distinction of starting this very disastrous trend.
And one aspect of this, I don't think, gets a lot of attention, and correct me if I'm right or not, but if you're sentenced, whether it's 2 to life, 15 to life, or 20 to life, you've technically gotten a life sentence. And for the duration of that sentence, even when you're on parole, you are no longer eligible to vote in New York State.
That's exactly right. If you're a prisoner in New York State or a parolee, you're not eligible to vote. So, for example, Elaine, she's been out of prison almost a year, a political activist. She couldn't vote in the last election.
Now, Elaine Bartlett, what did your lawyer tell you when you had the chance to plead out?
Well, my lawyer told me that they didn't have enough evidence to convict me, and he also told me that I would be allowed to take the stand and defend myself, which never happened.
Had you been involved with drugs before?
No. This is my first offense. I've never been arrested for anything, not even a parking ticket or jaywalking.
Now, can we compare this to murders? I mean, what people get for murder?
Certainly. People regularly for violent crimes get sentences that are even longer. And there are a lot of Rockefeller drug law prisoners who receive the mandatory sentence who now sit in prison watching people with violent crimes, with more egregious crimes, leave prison before them, serve shorter sentences and leave before them.
You wrote a piece in 1998 on the 25th anniversary of the Rockefeller drug laws, which, by the way, there's this growing movement in the state as well as against draconian drug laws around the country to overturn them. But
Joel Steinberg was a famous case in New York who killed his daughter, Lisa. I think he got 8 years to 25. Robert Chambers got less than that for killing Jennifer Levin.
Right, 5 years.
You got 20 years to life, and your partner, Nate Brooks, got 25 years to life. He's still in prison right now?
Yes, he's in Greenhaven Correction Facility.
Why didn't he plea bargain?
Well, Nate wanted to cop out to 5 to life if they would have set me free, but that didn't happen. They wanted both of us to cop out to 5 to life and to become informers, to come back to Manhattan and wear wires and set other people up. And basically, I didn't know any kingpins or king queens, so the people that we would have been setting up would have been people like ourselves.
What was it like for your children during this time, and how did they manage to cope with the reality of you being incarcerated all this time?
At the time, my children were 9, 6, 2, and 1. Basically, my 9-year-old and my 6-year-old, they had a couple of years with me before my incarceration. My 1 and 2-year-old, everything they know of me is from within the walls, through trailer visits and the visiting room. The Children's Center played a big aspect in our lives because that was the only communication, the only time I really got to play mommy was in that area.
We're going to have to break for stations to identify themselves. When we come back, we'll find out who took care of them during that time and what you're doing today now that you're out of prison. We're talking to Elaine Bartlett. She was one of 3 women last Christmas who was granted clemency by the New York governor, George Pataki. It is clemency time again around the country as we look at both the federal and state level who will get clemency. We're also talking to Jennifer Gonerman, who's done a 2-part series in The Village Voice. Today's cover story, Freedom's Cost. Elaine Bartlett beat the odds and won her freedom after 16 years in prison. Now she battles life on the outside. Last week's story, Inside Rikers Island, a portrait of the nation's largest penal colony. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Back in a minute. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman here with Juan Gonzalez, our guest, or Elaine Bartlett, who has now had a year's freedom, almost a year. She was at Bedford Hills, one of 2 women's prisons in New York State. It's the maximum security women's prison in New York State. She went into prison when she was 26 years old, got out when she was 41 years old. She was given a sentence of 20 years to life for carrying 4 ounces of cocaine between Harlem and Albany. Her partner, who was in the car with her, Nathan Brooks, got 25 years to life, and he remains in jail today. Her story is profiled by reporter Jennifer Gonerman in today's Village Voice. So your kids were very young. Who took care of them for the 16 years?
I was fortunate enough to have my mother raise them, not like other mothers. Most of them, their kids wind up in the foster care system. Thank God my children didn't have to go through that. But they still went through a lot over the years. My mother died in 1998, so coming home, I first tried to get clemency in 95. She became very ill, and that's what really initiated it. I didn't know anything about clemency, and I just took a chance and wrote a letter. Unfortunate that didn't happen. I didn't make it home in time enough to see her alive. My children have went through a lot. They had to alterate their lives and become incarcerated with me for them 16 years. For 16 years, they had to become part of that system with the visits, the trailers, and constantly coming. I remember one time we was in the visitor room, and my daughter, who's 18 now, my baby girl, Danae, she said to me, she was about 15 then. It was around clemency time, and people was getting clemency and stuff. We was in the visitor room. She said, "Mommy, what did you really do?" She got up very angry and threw her chair back. And I said, "What are you talking about? I explained to you why I'm here." She said, "Why are you lying to us? You couldn't have possibly just sold some drugs and be in here my whole life." And that was basically the type of things that I had to deal with. I'm a very happy woman to be home, and I'm grateful to have gotten clemency and had the opportunity to come back home and reunite with my family. But the reality is it that sometime after doing such a long time, you can come back to a situation that's worse than what you left. And that's basically what I'm dealing with now.
And Jennifer Gottman, I want to ask you, there's been quite a bit of pressure on Governor Pataki in the last couple of years to really do something about eliminating the Rockefeller drug laws. But up until now, he has sort of wanted to do an exchange, in essence. Okay, I will eliminate the Rockefeller drug laws, but in the same time, we've got to eliminate parole. What is your sense of where this battle is going in the next year?
I feel like the battles and the movement to reform, if not repeal, the Rockefeller drug laws has really been gaining momentum. 1998 marked the 25th anniversary of the Rockefeller drug laws. That day there was a rally. Some of Elaine's family members, I think, showed up at Rockefeller Center, maybe 50 people. Since then, the movement's growing in a really impressive fashion, and something that's happening in New York, which is starting to happen in other cities across the country, but I think New York perhaps is the first, is you have a lot of prisoners' family members, mothers, sons, girlfriends, wives, rallying, coming to sidewalk rallies, going to Albany, going down to the Shadow Convention that was held in coordination with the, to protest the Republican Convention in Philly, a trip down to D.C. several months ago to testify inside before some members of Congress. So there's really a lot of momentum growing, and I think for the first time there's real possibility that we could see serious reform to the Rockefeller drug laws this year. This question of a trade-off always looms, and this question of trading off with parole is particularly disturbing because changing the Rockefeller drug laws could obviously shrink the prison population, but of course if you eliminate parole, as Pataki insists that's exactly what he wants to do, you're going to not really see much of a decrease in the state's prison population.
Elaine Bartlett, you are becoming a spokesperson for this growing movement, and it's being called here the Mothers of the Disappeared. Now, we know that term for particularly groups of women in Latin America. Why the Mothers of the Disappeared?
Because so many mothers are disappearing, not only mothers, other family members too, but the mothers are disappearing. And when you start taking the mothers out of the household, I mean, for years we have had the men taken out the household and it's been all right. But when you take the mothers out the household, you're making it easier for our children to wind up in prison, too. For me, to come home and have to go and see my son, not only my husband in jail, but I have to go see my son in jail, too, that's a hard piece.
What happened to your son?
My son was convicted for a sale of controlled substance, and you would think that after his mother doing 16 years, that he wouldn't have took that route or went to the street and got caught up. But it's so easy for our kids to do. Because when our kids are in the community, we don't have centers. We don't have camps and stuff and the money that's affordable for us to be able to take our kids off the street. The drugs are not going nowhere. They have been out here I mean, this law has been 27 years old, and nothing has changed. And for me to sit in jail for under the Rockefeller laws for 16 years and then come home and only see the same thing going on like I never left it in the first place, it's sad. I could easily sit down and be quiet and put it all behind me or act like it doesn't exist, but every day that I wake up, I have to live it. Every day that I get up and I look in my children's face, I can't get them 16 years back. And I'm only one individual, but you have thousands that are sitting in jail for the Rockefeller laws, and their families are going through the same thing or either something worse because some of their kids are in foster care. I was fortunate enough to have my mother raise my children, but even with her raising them, it wasn't easy. I went through deaths in prison. I lost two brothers. I'm home now. I have a sister that's dying of AIDS. And no one has intervened into this family setting and helped them to deal with these issues. There's been no counseling for them. There's been no intervention. Everything they have dealt with on their own. So, in other words, in this apartment that they grew up in, they have created their own prison. When I came home to a bunch of teenagers that's very depressed, that have given up on life, and basically have no hope because no one intervened.
And of course, the Rockefeller drug laws became forerunners for mandatory sentencing laws all around the country. And it's a federal mandatory sentencing law that was Congress passed in 1985. And so those of you who are listening in other parts of the country, you undoubtedly have your own mandatory sentencing laws around drugs to confront. And as many people have said, it's probably the biggest attack on black and brown America today are the mandatory sentencing drug laws that are incarcerating so many young people who make mistakes.
It's something right now to point out that you could leave the whole prison scene behind. I mean, you were there for 16 years and now you got out. You've almost been out for a year, but you've decided to make it your life's mission is to focus on this issue and to continue rallies and protests, Elaine. I saw you more than a year ago at Bedford Hills. Mm-hmm. We got a chance to talk in the visiting room. Juan, you wrote a piece on Elaine 2 years ago while she was at Bedford Hills. Bedford Hills isn't a part of the nation's largest penal colony, Rikers Island, but Jennifer Gunnerman, the piece you did before profiling Elaine Bartlett is about this island in New York. Can you just give us a picture of it?
Certainly. The a story that ran in the Village Voice last week inside Rikers Island, a lot of people assume that Rikers Island, they've heard of it and they assume it's one prison. And in fact, Rikers Island is 10 different jails holding 80% of New York City's inmates. And it's a place where people go, most of the people there are detainees. We don't know if they're innocent or guilty, but they're there while they're waiting for their case to crawl through the city's courts, which is often a very long process, lasting up to 2 years in some cases. And a third of the people there are serving sentences of a year or less, or they're waiting for a bed to open up in an upstate prison. So the population there is constantly churning, but Rikers Island is part of many, many people's lives, in New York City in a way that that some parts of New York City's population can't imagine. For other people, Rikers Island is part of a sort of their day-to-day life, regardless of whether they're in prison there. And that's something I tried to show in this story that's in the Village Voice this week about Elaine Bartlett. I followed her, I guess it was 6 weeks after you came home from prison. She went to Rikers Island to visit her son, Jamal Pascal, who's now in an upstate facility. But just the idea that 6 weeks out of prison, a mother has to go back to jail to see her son, I just thought was unbelievable. And it's just part of the story of many, many families in New York City.
Rikers Island is a classroom for prison wardens and officials around the country and the world.
Right. It receives a great number of visitors, prison officials from around the world. Recently, the leader of Russia's prison system, which was was at one point the largest in the world, came to Rikers Island to visit. Prison officials from other states come all the time. From South Africa they've come. And partly it's because Rikers Island is so famous or notorious that they want to sort of be able to say that they've been there, almost as if it's the Empire State Building and a real tourist attraction for prison officials around the country. And also Rikers Island and the New York City Department of Correction in the last year or two has received quite a bit of positive publicity for bringing down violence and for a management program which grills wardens in public meetings to try to ascertain how much they know about what's going on in their facilities. And as a result of some of that positive publicity, they have received a great number of people who want to copy the sort of Rikers Island formula at their facilities across the country.
As we wrap up, Elaine Bartlett, for people around the country behind bars and those who are not in prison right now, what would you like to leave them with?
First of all, I want to say to all the people that are in prison, do not give up. It's a hard struggle, I know, because I've lived it and I'm still living it. But it takes people like us to come out and make a change, because no one knows what we go through but us. No one knows what we have to endure and our family members. And hopefully to the people that are not incarcerated, I just want you to know that we are human too. We make mistakes. And after we do our time or our sentence, we want to go on with our lives. We're not monsters. For 16 years, I was looked upon as 84G0068. That's not who I am. I am Elaine Bartlett, and that's who I want to be recognized and known for. For me, for my qualities, for the things that I have that God gave me, and not things that occurred in my life and made me make a bad decision. Also, on January 3rd, we're having a rally up in Albany. And hopefully all the mothers and family members that do have people incarcerated, come out, have a voice, and speak up. You can make a difference. I know a lot of y'all sit home and you feel helpless, like it's nothing that you can do and no one cares, but we do care. And in order to make a change, we have to make the change. Take your time to get up off them couches, cut off that TV, get away from the soap operas, and come out and make a difference. Stand up for what you believe in and for your loved ones, because they need you. The number you can call is 212-539-8441. We're out here and we're trying to help you. And the more of us that come out, the stronger our voices are, the more we can put a face to these numbers and just not be a statistic. Then we have a chance. Nothing comes easy, and we know that.
And by the way, if you want to get information, any contact numbers, or be able to hear this program on the web, you can go to WebActive, where we are archived and where you can hear any program. Just put WebActive in your search engine, and we're right at the top there.
And for those listeners who might want to give some personal assistance to Elaine Bartlett, and who's become an eloquent a defender and advocate for prison reform and drug sentencing reform, you can call that same number, 212-539-8441.
And if anyone's interested in reading Elaine's story from around the country, or last week's story about Rikers Island, the Village Voice has a website, which is www.villagevoice.com.
That's www.villagevoice.com. Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us. And again, the Coalition for Jubilee Clemency, which is the national group of 650 clergy asking Clinton to commute sentences of nonviolent low-level drug offenders to reunite them with their families for this holiday season. The contact information there is 202. This is in Washington, 312-2015. That's 202-312-2015. Tomorrow, we're going to have a debate on the Falun Gong. We'll be joined by Christopher Hitchens and Danny Schechter. We're also going to be talking about President-elect George Bush's national security advisor, Condoleezza Rice, and Colin Powell, and where they stand on Africa. Democracy Now! Produced by Terry Allen and Chris Abrams. Matthew Finch, our engineer. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for listening.
You're not going to get much answer from the House Select, Permanent Select.